Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for January 21st, 2008, and on this episode, we have an interview with director Robert Falls. He will be talking to Tom Williams about his latest show, Shining City. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, Chicago. And let's talk theater.
You are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. This is Tom Williams, and I'm here at the Goodman Theater, and I have the honor of speaking today with Robert Falls, who is the artistic director at the Goodman Theater, and he is, in my opinion, one of the great directors in America. Welcome, Robert.
I appreciate that, Tom. Thank you very much.
Well, that's sincerely true. Your latest production is Irish playwright Connor McPherson's Shining City. So tell us now how you met McPherson and how you got to direct this play.
Oh, that's it's a fun story because it goes back to, I believe, 1992. So what are the 15 years? I actually met Connor when I was working in Dublin. I went there in 92 to mount it was a combination of a revival and a new production of Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh, which had had an enormous success here with Brian Dennehy.
I do remember that.
Yeah, in, I believe, 1989. And we were invited to remount the production with Brian, a few Americans, and an Irish cast at the Great Abbey Theater in Dublin, Ireland's national theater. And this young guy, about a 21-year-old guy, came up and introduced himself to me somewhere in the process, this sort of, you know, freckle-faced, red-headed Irish kid who introduced himself as Connor McPherson, all of age 21, I think, who said he was a playwright. He knew I was from Chicago. He knew I was from the Goodman, and he wanted to tell me that it was David Mamet that it had inspired him to start writing plays. And did I know Mr. Mamet? And I said, indeed I did. I'd worked with him many times, and our careers basically began around the same time in the mid-70s. And so Connor and I became very friendly, and Connor kind of was hanging around that production and saw it a number of times, and we had a number of drinks together, and he was just this amazing guy. And he gave me some of his plays to read, which were remarkable. And lo and behold, it was about 10 years went by, and I turned around and I realized that this play, The Weir, which had been successfully produced in London and Dublin and was now being produced around the world, was one of the most produced plays of its time, was written by the very same Connor McPherson, who has since gone on to become, I think, Ireland's leading contemporary playwright.
I agree.
So we've remained in touch over the years, and what happened on Broadway was that I believe in 2005, Connor had, a great success with the original production of Shining City, which he did in Dublin and at the Royal Court Theatre in London, was going to bring the production onto Broadway, and for a number of reasons couldn't do it, decided not to do it. It ended up at the Manhattan Theatre Club, which is a nonprofit theater like the Goodman, and Connor recommended me as the director, really thought I'd be a terrific director for this piece, so he sent me the play, and indeed, I read it and fell in love with it from the moment I read it and said I would be honored to direct it. So I did so in New York, and I'm thrilled to be doing it again with a Chicago company here in Chicago.
Well, tell us now, I know it was nominated for Best Play.
Yeah,
for a Tony.
It was nominated for a Tony for Best Play, as was the leading actor Oliver Platt, who was nominated for the role of John, which is being played by a great Chicago actor John Judd, who's playing it here in Chicago.
Yeah, so tell us what folks can expect with The Shining City, because this is the first Chicago production.
Yeah, it's one of the first productions, actually. I think it was done in Washington, D.C., but it's one of the first, certainly the major production outside of New York since it had its Broadway success. It is the Chicago premiere. Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful play. It's both funny and deeply moving, I think, that begins with a man, a distraught Dubliner, a businessman, who comes into a therapist's office on a rainy night and says, I need to talk to somebody. And the therapist says, have a seat on the couch. And the patient begins to reveal that he has seen the ghost of his recently deceased wife, that he's being haunted by the ghost of his wife. And this, of course, is a vexing situation for any therapist. But he takes the challenge, and we enter into a series of scenes of the relationship between this patient, who has considerable guilt and fear and anxieties. And at the same time, the play follows the life of the therapist, which is almost as complex as the life of the patient.
And that's Jay Whittaker.
Jay Whittaker. Yeah, wonderful actor, Jay Whittaker.
You have two of the most intense actors in Chicago. Yeah, two of the best.
They're fantastic. Yeah. They're just great actors. I actually saw them do one of my favorite productions of the past couple of years was a Carol Churchill play. A number, which was done up at the Next Theater.
Yes, so that's we were talking earlier
in
about
Evanston.
I couldn't remember the name.
It was called A Number by Carol Churchill, and they were just fantastic in it. And I've been fans of both of them for a long time, and worked with Jay Whittaker last year on Richard Nelson's play. He played Frank Lloyd Wright's son, and I thought they were both perfect actors for this play. So we've been having a great time with it, and you know, it's an Irish play, but in a contemporary way. You know, I think a lot of our audiences may think of the Irish plays as Begorra, you know, the old sod back there. But it's a contemporary play set in modern Dublin. It's about four lonely individuals. It's about the human condition. It's about the need for connections that human beings have, reaching out towards each other. And it's also about guilt and superstition. It's about the role of God in the universe in a modern world. You know, Connor writes exquisite dialogue.
Yes, he does.
He writes just exquisite monologues. He writes exquisite dialogue. And I just think there's something for everybody in the play. It's a really wonderful play.
He reminds me of the Irish storytelling. But it also has bits of Pinter and Mamet and Beckett in it.
He's been influenced by all of them. I mean, Mamet is an influence, and certainly Mamet was strongly influenced by both Beckett and Pinter. And I think Connor has those same roots. But he also, as you said, Tom, has his roots in Irish storytelling. There's a great, great storyteller. And one of the things that Connor became famous for was the monologue. He spins a tale like virtually no other contemporary writer.
That's right. The Weir is one of the great examples of that. Each of them in the bar gets to tell their story in some
each of them has monologue. A story that they tell. For a long time, the early plays that he gave me back in Dublin were basically solo plays by characters who would tell these stories. So very early on, Connor mastered the form of the storyteller. And he subsequently moved away from that. You know, he has an enormous hit on Broadway right now. He's the toast of Broadway again this season with The Seafarer, which is a play that has no monologues in it. Okay. So he's moving away from it, but he retains a sort of rich Irish tradition of sort of very musical storytelling in his work.
And what, other than the fact that he wanted you to do it and you liked the play, what was your approach to the play, given it a, you know, your background and a distinctly American point of view?
That was an interesting thing, and Connor actually wanted that a little bit. I mean, the play, I've done that before a couple of times with British plays or Irish plays, because I've spent a lot of time in Ireland, and I sort of identify myself as an Irish American. My grandparents both actually came from Dublin in the 20s, so I know quite a bit about it. But there was something, it was helpful, I think, for me to direct the American premiere, because working with Connor, I was able to sort of, we made a few changes. We took out a few things that were maybe a little too Irish specific for an Irish audience. We kind of opened it up to an American audience. You know, I think it's a universal play. I mean, I think it's a play like any great writer. It works on a very, very universal level. And while he's especially interested in the lives of these four Dubliners, they could equally be four Chicagoans or four New Yorkers or four people who are kind of lost in a giant city. They're sort of isolated unto themselves with their own problems. You know, I just one of the things I think is because I've done such big plays, and the last play I did on the main stage was the epic, you know, King Lear.
We'll talk about that later.
Which was
one of the great pieces of theater that I have ever seen.
Well, thank you. I mean, it was tremendous fun, and I love working on a grand scale. But one of the things I loved about this play was the fact that it was a chance to do something very quiet. People rarely raise their voices in this play. A lot of people, at times they barely move. They sit on a couch, they tell their stories, they sit in a chair. And I find that fascinating, that the theater can embrace things as epic as 3.5 hours of Shakespeare, thundering drama in every sense, but it can also be something as intimate as Connor McPherson's little play about four lost souls.
Well, it certainly necessitates a couple of great actors, And all four, but particularly your two leads are just the kind of people that could carry off a... If the writing's good, John Judd and Jay Whitaker can handle it.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm thrilled with them. I'm absolutely thrilled. It was always my intention. I mean, I knew when we did the show in New York that I wanted our Goodman audiences to see it. I wanted Chicago audiences to see it. A couple of the Chicago critics saw it and loved the play, and a lot of people from Chicago saw the play and said, this is something the Goodman must do. So very early on, I said, well, we're going to get this at the Goodman at some point. I originally did invite the Broadway cast because I thought, well, you know, we've had a great time working on this. But it became apparent to me that for them, they'd done the play. They were all moving on in their careers to other things, to other jobs. And I just saw that as a great opportunity to cast four terrific Chicago's actors. And we also have, you know, Nicole Wiesner, who's just a remarkable, remarkable actor, who's just been incredibly seasoned by her work at Trapdoor Theater and
right.
some of the other small theaters here. And
she's grown. I've seen her grow from being this young storefront actress to a
She's an amazing actress who just stormed the stage in Passion Play.
Right.
And another actor, Keith Gallagher, who's, I think, 23 years old. He's just out of DePaul. And he's a remarkable young actor making his professional debut. So it's a fantastic company. And I think that's part of the pleasure of doing the play the second time is that you reinvestigate it with four different actors and you find completely new things in it because of their experience.
Well, you've got to be proud of this. Do you see McPherson's present play coming here to Chicago?
I would love to present his present play. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it just started what I hope will be a long, successful run in New York. But I have spoken with him and said, look, Connor, you know, we've got a wave of Connor McPherson love happening at the Goodman. And I think we're going to have a great success with Shining City. And we'd love to follow that up whenever you want with The Seafarer. So hopefully that door is open and that our audiences will be able to see another Connor play in the next year or two.
Well, that's great because we love his work here, as you know. And this is a good town for Irish theater.
It is. It's a wonderful town for it.
Well, let's move on. Let's talk about your career. You've had a tremendous run. In doing some of my research, I found that you were a senior in college when you produced Man-Child, the Michael Weller play.
Moon Children.
I'm sorry, Moon Children. And you won Jeff's citation.
I did. I was in college. I was a senior at the University of Illinois in downstate Champaign-Urbana. And I had produced that play and directed that play when I was a sophomore. And it was sort of a major production for a lot of us. And a whole group of us moved up to Chicago, including Stuart Oaken and Jason Brett, who became independent producers and created the Apollo Theater on Lincoln Avenue. But as their first production for Apollo Productions, they decided to professionally produce Moon Children, which I came back up to Chicago in my senior year and directed. It was the second production to follow American Buffalo at what was then the old St. Nicholas Theater in 1977 or 76. No, it was 76. It was 1976 and kind of launched my career in 1976 while I was a senior in college.
But from what I had heard, that you had directed before that, though you started at around 18 years old.
Well, I've been directing.
Some of that early background of how you got involved.
I've been directing for a long time. I mean, I just have always been directing. I mean, I probably started directing plays when I was about 10 or 11 years old. I just from the earliest age, I knew I wanted to be a theater director. I was also interested in writing, and I was also interested in acting, and I did a lot of that at the University of Illinois, where I was an undergraduate. But pretty much from my senior year, when I was. I was directing at the age of 18, but I really kind of began professionally, I think, when I was about 21 when I came up to Chicago to do Moon Children.
Well, you had quite a string there each year. Then you took over Wisdom Bridge, and Of Mice and Men was another award.
Well, we're going a long time back here, okay. Tom. That's 30 years ago. That was my career began in Chicago with a lot of other people, like I said, including David Mamet, a lot of people who are still around, in about 1976, 1977. And I went from kind of my first year professionally in Chicago working to very quickly getting a job at Wisdom Bridge Theater. Now, when I say getting a job, I'm talking about a time when it was actually sort of city supported at that time. There was a program called CETA, which was an opportunity the city provided for small companies of any sort to have employees. And I think for about grand total of about $80 a week, I was made artistic director up there on Howard Street of the Wisdom Bridge Theater, where I stayed for 10 years.
Well, then, and I also read 1985 when you did Hamlet with Aidan Quinn.
Right.
And a lot of people were saying that was such a passionate production that they had started out with blood all over the stage. And
well, it started with that was a real, real major kind of breakthrough production for me. It was a play I'd wanted to do for a long time. And Aidan Quinn was 24 years old at the time, and he was a brilliant Hamlet. And it's a play, you know, it was a modern dress production of Hamlet, as I think Hamlet should be. It's a play for young people, and it was kind of created for young audiences. And it started with a very arresting image of a coffin on stage. And as we heard the celebratory bells ringing of Gertrude and Claudius's marriage, this coffin where the late King Hamlet was obviously laid began to bubble up and overflow with blood. And that was the first image. It was horror film image.
But, yeah, and one of the quotes from you from that was that you like messy, passionate work, and that at that time you were kind of frightened of Shakespeare?
I wasn't a particularly experienced Shakespearean director. I still am not. I've done three Shakespeare productions in 30 years, and that was the first one. And I still like big, messy plays, and I like my Shakespeare kind of big and messy, and so that hasn't changed in 30 years.
You also believe they should be set, at least the tragedy should be set in contemporary times.
I do. I think almost all of Shakespeare's plays look better in pants than pantaloons. So I'm just a big advocate personally for, when I do Shakespeare, setting it in modern dress and trying to find the corollary, the modern references in all Shakespeare. I just think that, for me, it was a great breakthrough when I realized that Shakespeare's plays essentially were produced in modern dress for his audience. You know, they weren't done in period clothing. They were done in Elizabethan costuming, and they were presented to the audience. You know, the actors would come out and say, here we are, we're telling a story of ancient Greece, but yet they were wearing Elizabethan clothing. And that seems to me an indication of how Shakespeare wanted his plays done, and so I tend to follow that when I produce Shakespeare.
Okay, but there was a big gap in there where you didn't do a lot of Shakespeare.
Right.
But what drove you to King Lear that you just did a couple of years ago?
I was aware that I had not done Shakespeare in a long, long time. And I'd sort of fallen off the Shakespeare bandwagon in favor of new plays. I also spent a lot of time, as you know, working with classics of the American repertoire, Tennessee Williams and Eugene O'Neill in particular, and Arthur Miller. But Lear was a particular play for me that I've been obsessed with for a long period of time. I had studied it. I've seen many productions of it. I'd thought about it. It's a play which made a great deal of sense to me. It was also a play that I felt for my 20th anniversary, which was last season. As it was coming up, I said, I've got to do something sort of unique and special and challenging and difficult. And, well, King Lear kind of fit the bill for that. So I kind of just threw myself into doing a King Lear for my 20th anniversary.
It was one of the marvelous pieces of theater. Yeah, it was really...
It was really, you know, it was very much a sort of companion piece to Hamlet, which was, gosh, like I said, 25 years earlier. And I wanted to recapture... I wanted to recapture the energy and the sort of kind of bit of a madness, wildness that I had 25 years ago, which as you age becomes harder and harder to maintain. You know, I think as you do get older, you tend to mellow in a different way. You tend to get better at certain things. And at the same time, I think sometimes you lose the edges of your early work. And I wanted with the Lear to sort of hold on to things I've learned as a mature director, but also get in touch with some of the wildness that I had when I was a very, very young director.
Well, you certainly did that. And a lot of people say, well, I heard people ripping the show by saying, well, it's Falls going back to what he used to do so good. And I turned around and said, well, you should be thankful for that, because that's exactly what we wanted.
Well, you know, we had a great run of it. Yeah. You know, we had a great response.
Stacy Keach was fabulous.
He was phenomenal. Yeah. He's just, I think he's America's greatest Shakespeare actor, and certainly our most experienced, majestic actor. I loved the response it had. I mean, I knew that it would be controversial, and I wanted that. I feel that with Shakespeare's great plays, they can withstand strong interpretation. And so to me, part of the pleasure of seeing Shakespeare is to be able to argue about it. I like arguing about Shakespeare. I like going and seeing Shakespeare productions and having a strong opinion and arguing with somebody about it. So I was thrilled that I was able to do that.
Well, it brought you back to the roots because when I was looking at some of the background, I mean, you started out when you took over the Goodman. One of your missions was to sort of revitalize this institution. And you started out with Brecht's Galileo, then you did Pal Joey. Mm-hmm. Those are pretty controversial plays.
Those were the early days of coming to the Goodman. The Goodman, when I came to it, was, of course, a wonderful Chicago institution, but it had kind of shifted its emphasis under the direction of my predecessor, Gregory Mosier, who was best known for his collaborations with David Mamet. And they were doing a lot of new plays and a lot of new work. And I felt that their identity was a little confused with that of most of the smaller theaters, including Wisdom Bridge. And given the size of the stage and the staff and the budgets of the theater, I really did want to sort of go in and tackle some big stuff, including classic writing like Brecht and Shakespeare, Chekhov and Moliere and Ibsen. And so that has sort of formed the backbone of a lot of the work over the past 20 years was big productions of classical work. And at the same time, continuing to come back and doing new writers and new work.
Well, and then I read where you said, and this is a quote, an artistic director's job is to lead the audience and to present work to the audience that is challenging and provocative. So you love to challenge the audience.
I think that's essential. I mean, I think otherwise the audience is falling to sleep and you're like a conductor of a sort of sleepy symphony. You know, I think audiences coming to the theater, particularly this theater, but most theater in Chicago, want to be challenged. They don't want to be turned off. They don't want to be offended. But they do want a level of challenge. You know, they do want a level of surprise. They don't want to just be lulled into complacency with things they've seen before. They want the challenge of the new presented to them. So it's a tricky job, you know, trying to always stay a step ahead of an audience. You know, I mean, it's always amazing to me that there are theaters all over the country that do these sort of audience surveys where they ask the audiences the plays they want to see, you know, and they'll send out to the audiences, we're thinking about doing these 10 plays next year and check off the 4 you'd like to see most. And I've always found that ridiculous. I think that the job of the artistic director is to be a leader and for better or for worse to sort of define the artistic mission of the theater. And if the audience is happy, they'll come. And if they're unhappy, they'll stop coming. And fortunately, we've had, you know, 21, 22 years of people coming here.
Well, you're up to what, around 24,000 subscribers?
Yeah, we've basically maintaining that number for a long time, yeah.
And so obviously that formula has worked.
I think so.
Yeah. And as long as you keep, you know, keep the variety, because you started doing these festivals, talk about that.
Yeah. Well, that's been a kind of a new thing in the past couple of years, which just always intrigued me, and we've been doing them now to great success, which is the opportunity to see we do kind of two kind of festivals. We've been doing the Latino Festival for a number of years, which is an amazing opportunity to see work from Latino theaters all around the world, and we do that every other year. But beginning a couple of years ago with Edward Albee. I mean, I thought here was this amazing career. I mean, Edward just turned 80. This was 5 years ago when he was 75. And I thought, well, Edward has written these two fantastic plays, a play about the baby and the goat. I mean, it's an amazing kind of third act for a mature American playwright. So I knew I wanted to do those plays, but I said, well, you know, he's also the master of the short play. I mean, his short work, Zeus Story, American Dream are masterpieces.
I agree.
And I thought, well, this would be a great chance to go back and look at Edward, the body of Edward's work. So, you know, we put together this whole program that included Edward speaking and people talking about Edward's work and actors. And it was just an enormous success and a great pleasure for this theater to get into detail with one writer's work. And we've tried to do that on a fairly regular basis with August Wilson, with David Mamet, and now with Horton Foote. And so it's become another sort of fun thing that we all look forward to here.
Tell us about that, because that's coming up.
Horton Foote, like Edward, is an American master. Horton Foote, at the age of 91 or 2, I think I'm checking with Denise, he's 92, is, you know, he's a legend. And I think that, unlike Edward, unlike Arthur Miller, his work wasn't produced originally that much on Broadway. He did a lot of his original writing off-Broadway, and he's also as known for his remarkable screenplays and his television plays as anything else. You know, this is a guy who adapted brilliantly one of the great movies, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird, and also wrote Tender Mercies, that great film with Robert Duvall. And in the past couple of years, I should say more than that, 20 years, he's continued to devote himself to these absolutely gem-like plays that get produced around the country. He's a regional writer in the best sense of the word, that he's a Texan, and he tends to write, all of his plays tend to take place in the same location of a mythical town of Harrison, Texas, which is based on his own hometown, Wharton, Texas. And just looking back over his body of work and rereading his plays, I thought, well, this guy is great, and it's time to really celebrate him. And, you know, I think that we're doing four plays by Horton, and I think it's going to be a great opportunity for our audiences to see this wonderful, wonderful writer in a festival setting.
And Denise was telling me that he likes to come see his work and go to the rehearsals, and he's hands-on.
He's totally hands-on. He's a total hands-on guy. He started out his career almost, more than a half a century ago as an actor. He's an actor's writer. Actors love him. He loves actors. So he loves being a part of the process. And if he could, he'd be here for all of the rehearsals, and he'd be here for every single performance. But at his age, he's got a lot of responsibilities. It's harder for him to get around. He'll be part of the festival later on. He'll be here a lot. And I'm leaving out, you know, speaking of a great performance, but Lois Smith gives, I think, a defining world-class performance as Miss Carrie Watts in The Trip to Bountiful, a real masterpiece by Horton.
That is a great play.
Which is going to be the centerpiece of the festival, and that's going to be something for people to see. It's an amazing company of actors led, you know, by Harris Yulin as the director, but with this spectacular performance by Lois Smith, who, you know, much of your audience are familiar with from her work at Steppenwolf. But, you know, Lois goes back to, you know, East of Eden with James Dean.
And, wow, and, I didn't realize that.
Oh, she was in East of Eden with James Dean, and she also, you know, gave one of the great performances in the 70s opposite Jack Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces.
That's
She plays
right.
his piano-playing sister. So she's one of America's greatest actresses playing one of the great roles in the American dramatic literature.
Well, you got to be proud to bring these people in. But
oh, yeah.
You've got a history then. Let's go out. Your college buddy, Stuart Olcom, gave you a call when he was doing Aida, when he was running Disney. Mm-hmm. And you got one of those calls that's kind of right out of almost like a 42nd Street or something.
42nd
Street.
Yeah,
little come out here and fix the play.
Well, I'd always wanted to. You know, I've done operas in my life, and I love the American musical. I love musicals. And Stuart Olcom, a Chicagoan, as I've already referred to him, not only did we go to college together, but Stuart produced my first play, Moon Children. We go that far back. Stuart ended up an executive working in the creative department of Disney Theatrical. And along with his colleagues, was working with Elton John and Tim Rice on a musical that was in some trouble called Aida down in Atlanta. It was Broadway bound, and they asked me to come in and look at it and give some notes on it, which I did. And I gather they liked what I had to say, because about a week later they asked me if I would be willing to take over as director and kind of put together my own production and rethink it and redesign it and rework it. And I hesitated for about 5 minutes, but I realized I'd always wanted the experience of doing a big Broadway musical, and I might not get another chance, so I sort of jumped at it, and that became like a five-year journey, really, for me. That was like 5 years of, we put it together very quickly, meaning we had about a year from the time I came on to the time it opened on Broadway, which included a stint here in Chicago, and then it ran for 4.5 years on Broadway, and I'm enormously proud of that production and that collaboration with Disney. It was a lot of fun, and I certainly learned a lot.
So I see you're coming up. You're going to be directing another musical.
Yeah, it's been a long time, and this is a new musical.
Stuart Olcom was involved in this too, because I saw the production he did it. They did it.
Northwestern. Oh, did you see that?
Yes,
it was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a terrific score. And
it's a terrific piece. It's The Boys Are Coming Home by Leslie Arden and Rebecca Gilman. It's a kind of a swing pop musical that uses the vernacular of the 1940s to tell a story that is both comic and dramatic. It's based on Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. about the boys coming home from World War II and being reunited with the women who've been running the workforce.
It's also kind of an early women's lib sort of
very
piece.
Much
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
It's a piece about female empowerment. It's a story about what happens with the women who have been working in the factories. They've been really sort of running the world while the boys were off at war, and now the boys have come home, and what happens to an America that is changing. And it was a terrific workshop under Stewart's sort of producership at Northwestern. Gary Griffin, great Chicago director, did a terrific job. But we decided to bring it to the Goodman and to rework it. We brought Rebecca Gilman, I think one of Chicago's finest writers, in to work on the book and to create a new story and to work with Leslie Arden, the great composer-lyricist. And, you know, I just, again, find myself stepping in on a musical. It was originally going to be directed by my colleague David Petrarca, who had worked years ago with Leslie Arden on a tremendous musical called The House of Martin Guerre.
Yes.
Which was just one of the best things we've ever done. And David is in demand in both television and film right now, and it looks like he's got his first film is coming up. And so he had to withdraw because of these prior commitments for film. And I thought, well, this is an opportunity. I think this is everybody's way of telling me I should do another musical. So I was thrilled to sort of step in. It was a good time for me, and I loved my collaborators, and I'm looking forward at the end of the season to doing The Boys Are Coming Home.
Well, I can't wait, because I thought it was pretty close when Gary Griffin did it.
Yeah.
It needed a few little things, but it was pretty close.
It's pretty close.
And I think the level, what you will take it to the next level,
yeah.
And with your experience, I have a feeling
the
score is terrific.
It's a great story, yeah. And it's a great score.
Yeah,
and it needed a little tweaking, and I think it's going to be a real hit for us this summer.
I got a feeling it's going to be heading out to New York. Is that
part
of the plan?
You never know. You never know. I mean, at this point, there are no plans. I mean, the great thing about working on a musical or anything new is until you get it up, you don't know what it is, and we're under no pressure. My feeling about New York is it's wonderful if a play, you know, you look at a play like Tracy Letts' great success with August, Osage County. My feeling is good work gets seen. And if you do something really remarkable here in Chicago and you produce it for Chicagoans, as Tracy did, or as we're planning on doing with The Boys Are Coming Home from, if it's really good, other people will get a chance to see it as well.
Yeah, and it'll attract what it needs,
yeah.
A producer, the finances.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I feel that way.
I agree with you. So, and we're a fair city to open new plays, because I think we're sophisticated, but we're not necessarily...
we're the best.
We're jaded, and we don't have this... We don't overproduce them. How many times a Broadway shows get overproduced, and then when they come to Chicago, when our great directors here rethink them,
yeah.
And make them more intimate or whatever it needs.
Yeah,
it
happens all the time.
Yeah.
No, there's no doubt. I mean, my whole career has been Chicago. It's been 30 years of directing in Chicago, and I've been lucky to have a few hits that have gone on to New York, and I love New York as a place to celebrate the work, but it's sort of unthinkable for me to create the work in New York. I love being able to make it here at home. And like I said, if it's got legs, it'll go somewhere. And, you know, Chicago, it's cyclical. There have been times where Chicago's been a little more in, it's been a little more out. But right now, and rightly so, I think New York and Chicago have a wonderful relationship to each other. Wonderful. New York knows how important Chicago is to the national theater scene. And you know, both for big Broadway musicals trying out here, and for emerging Chicago companies and writers, it's there's never been a better time in terms of collaboration between our two cities.
And what about casting of Chicago actors? I think we have as good actors in Chicago as anywhere.
There's no question. We have the best actors in the United States. There's absolutely no question. It's actors in Chicago have an opportunity to work. They have an opportunity to grow. They get tremendous experience. I mean, I've always said this about Chicago theater artists in general, but it probably is most specifically applied to actors. The great thing about Chicago is that it's almost impossible to fail, and it's also impossible to succeed in the way that in New York you do. You know, in New York, if you succeed, it's a grand success. You can hit a home run, and you're on the cover of Time magazine. On the other hand, if you fail, if you flop, it can be a real career ender. And the thing about Chicago artists, particularly actors, is, you know, you get up, you go to work, you do your play, you open, and you get up the next day and you go to work on another play or the same play. And nobody really gives a shit. To some extent, what's wonderful is you just do your work. And year after year, if you do your work, you get really, really good. And lo and behold, you're suddenly a fantastic actor. Or you're a fantastic playwright.
And we don't have big egos here. One day you're the star, the next day you're the ensemble.
Yeah, I think it's sort of an ensemble town. It's a company-driven town. And there is certainly a lack of pretense about it. That's what I meant. It's hard to have a kind of ego, you know, because everybody's working to do the best job in a play. They're not. You can't get famous in Chicago. You just can't. So nobody's really thinking about that, which does dominate the scene in New York because it can happen so easily.
Yes, I can see that. Well, in the interest of time, I always like to ask this question. And obviously, I'm not going to. The general question is, what do you want to be doing in 5 years? We know that directing plays. So the real question is, what plays are on your agenda? What are you passionate about doing now?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and it's the question I ask myself. And I have to say, I never really have a master plan of, like, 5 years from now I want to be doing. You know, there are times where like, a play like King Lear is sort of on the horizon 5 years in advance. But at the moment, you know, it's hard for me to say. You know, I would like to be, there's a couple of projects that I'm thinking about musically,
okay.
Collaborations with people that I'd love to work on. I'm always excited to be working on the plays of Eugene O'Neill.
You have that coming up with.
Well, I'm going to be doing A Desire Under the Elms, but, you know, there's probably another three or four that I'd like to do. There's another two or three Tennessee Williams plays I'm interested in. There's another two or three Arthur Miller plays. There's the great pleasure of doing what I do is that I can continually read and think, and I get to read Shakespeare, I get to read Eugene O'Neill, I get to read Chekhov. I'd love to do something. You know, there's a play by Chekhov called Platonov, which is an early play. It's his first play, and it contains all. He wrote it when he was 20, and it contains all the seeds and all the themes of his later plays. And it's a play I've sort of been obsessed with. And that is a play sometime in the next 5 years. I'd love to do Chekhov's Platonov. I've never done a play by Samuel Beckett, and I love his very, very short pieces. So I'd love to do something by Beckett, perhaps. So the pleasure is thinking about these great writers like Beckett or Chekhov or Shakespeare or O'Neill, but then also the great surprise of opening your mail and finding a play delivered to my desk by a young writer nobody's ever heard of and reading it and just being knocked out by it. And, you know, there's a writer named Noah Heidel here. We did a play of his that I thought was just wonderful. And Noah, I think, is an extremely gifted young writer. And he's written a whole series of plays that I'm excited by. So I'm very excited by the future. And I think in the next couple of years, we're going to continue to see some great stuff.
Well, I hope you continue to do what I've been doing for years, and that's challenge the audience.
Thanks, Tom.
And give us such a terrific variety of work that thank you so much for the interview. And folks, make sure you get out and see Shining City. I'm sure it'll be a terrific production because, Bob, you're one of those directors that if your name is on it, you got to go see it.
Well, that's great of you to say. I've certainly been around long enough that I hope there's an audience that wants to see something that I'm interested in. They certainly have at the Goodman. And, you know, I think they're great plays. And if people come, I think they're going to have a good time.
Yeah, I do too. Well, just remember, folks, go see a play this week. And thank you for listening.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of January 21st, 2008. Signal Ensemble Theater culminates its fifth season with the Tony Award-winning musical, 1776. The production starts this January 25th at the Chopin Theater. Set during the hot-as-hell summer in Philadelphia, 1776 is about a seminal act in American history, the signing of the Declaration of Independence, as sectional differences, pride, and fear threaten our fledgling nation. This is a very stripped-down version of 1776, emphasizing minimalism so that the focus will be on the actors. Previews are set to start this January 25th. The production will be running through March 1st. Tickets can be purchased online at signalensemble.com, or for your chance to receive a special offer of half-price tickets to 1776, click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. New on the Theater in Chicago news pages this week is Joe Stead's exclusive interview with Madrid St. Angelo. A veteran of the local theater and member of the Screen Actors Guild, SAG to you and I, Madrid is currently the artistic director of the People's Theater of Chicago. Their current production is the world premiere of Flowers Out of Season that will be opening this February 2nd at Chicago's EP Theater. You have to check out this interview and read about the interesting life of Madrid St. Angelo. For more information about the company, about the man, and about the world premiere of Flowers Out of Season, visit peoplestheaterchicago.org. But of course, you can click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section to read Joe Stead's exclusive interview. After 25 years with the Appletree Theater in Highland Park, founding artistic director Eileen Bovers has announced her resignation from the company. Appletree Theater is one of Chicago's highest regarded theater companies, and oddly enough, the company began in the same little church basement as Steppenwolf. A new artistic director has not been announced yet. However, Mark Weston will now act as the interim executive director, while Mark Lococo will take on the temporary role as artistic consultant. Stay tuned to Talk Theater in Chicago when a new artistic director will be announced. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. We have come to the end of the news, but before I let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare quote of the week. The following quote comes from The Tragedy of King Richard II, Act 5, Scene 3. Thy overflow of good converts to bad. Blah-dow, another week down. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago. And I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Robert Falls for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.